Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear. Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Today is February 10th, Wednesday, and you know what that means. It's our interview day. I am super excited about the guest that we have on today. We have Patty Amino, who I consider to be an anti-nuke warrior, not just an activist, because she has won against the nuclear industry. And this is actually kind of a shout-out also to Libby Halevi and the Nuclear Hot Seat, because without Libby's interview of Patty Amino, I would never have known about her story. So we really want to thank the hard work and diligence of Libby Halevi for doing her work and digging out these stories that all of us need to know. This is the vital, vital importance of networking, listening to this, the radio shows here on UCY.TV, because there is information on this radio station that you will not get on any other station anywhere. So without any further ado, I want to introduce to you Patty. Patty, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks, Lonnie, and thanks for having me.
Hey, so let me ask you, can you hear me properly right now? Because I know my headsets are going dodgy on me. Are you okay?
Well, I don't know if it's proper or not, but yes, I can hear you fine.
Perfect. Okay, so if you can hear me, our listeners can hear me. So Patty is an anti-nuke activist who's actually won against, she has spent 26 years fighting her fight. Patty, why don't you kind of give a quick summation you can give us, or do you want me to ask you questions? Can you give us a quick summation of how you got engaged in this and what happened to your life because of the nuclear industry?
Well, actually, it was 27 years this past December, Lonnie, and it was after I had retired out from the federal government when I came back home in December of 1988, where my father had got me to promise to look into the plant that was across the street. And, you know, I didn't know it was a nuclear facility.
You mean the plant across the street from your house where you grew up?
That's correct. It was less than 100 feet across the street from my house. Now, NUMEC was the company that first went in there, with the first owners, and you have to understand the layout, the demographics of Apollo. It's this plant sat right up against the main highway. It was less than 100 feet from my house, in a valley with inversion, and it had 124 stacks. And then when you know, right up against that roadway, you know, a lot of those stacks had hoods. And, you know, there was a downwind from that. And then you think about the main road going through that town, Route 66, and the cars being driven there, which attributed to the kicking up of this known as roadway resuspension. And you know, I mean, this was just you know, in thinking back on all of this, the history, I mean, coming up, and the awareness that grasped my mind, and just, you know, in 1988, and, you know,
wow,
through right now.
Well, let me jump in here, Patty. Let me ask you some questions that are popping up in my head. When you say Apollo, you're talking about Apollo, Pennsylvania?
I am, Apollo, Pennsylvania.
And where is Apollo geographically? Kind of give us a sense of where that's at in relation, say, to Three Mile Island, because most of us know where that's at.
Well, okay, I can give it to you in relationship to Pittsburgh.
Okay, great.
We are approximately 25 miles north of Pittsburgh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and again, okay, the NUMEC started up in 1957 in Apollo. And in 1960, they built, this was actually a facility that was built. They started their first ever commercial, privately owned, plutonium fabricating facility. And that facility abutted a dairy farm. And that dairy farm, Farmers Delight Dairy, gave milk to all the schools in this area, free.
Wow.
Yeah, bet you that milk did the body good.
Wow. So what does is NUMEC the name of the company, or is that an acronym? What does NUMEC mean?
That's an acronym, and it stood for Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation. And NUMEC was actually, it's actually very infamous on an international scale, because the Apollo plant was so sloppy, and they had so many events, accidents, and several fires and loss of material. Their design of their production line was faulty, and material would just be going all over the place. And so because they were so sloppy, there came a story of an alleged diversion of nuclear material that allegedly went to Israel and allegedly gave Israel the bomb. I can tell you, with every fiber in me, it didn't happen.
Good. Thank God for that. So we know it did not come from there. Thank God for that. That's good.
Well, it knowing is another thing. The evidence is pointing to the area of what is more likely than not. There has never been any proof to substantiate that. Huh. And it's only been, it's been speculation. A lot of it's been fueled by anti-Semitism,
people are fearful that, you know, a country's going to have a nuclear bomb and nobody really knows about it. That's the big anxiety, you know.
Well, it was more of the industry covering up something that was a negative to the industry. I mean, you can't say anything negative then or even now about the three key words, and that is nuclear, radiation, or atomic.
That's actually very true. You were not allowed to say one. I heard Guy McPherson basically said, he was interviewed on CNN. They asked him to come on to talk about climate change, and they said he wanted to say how Fukushima was exacerbating climate change, not that it was causing it, but it was exacerbating it. They said you cannot mention the word Fukushima or radiation or we will cut off your mics.
Huh. You know, that's not surprising. And,
so what
you know,
do you mean by stacks? When you say there were so many stacks, what does that mean?
There were so many stacks. The stacks for admissions, they were admitting on a continuum.
What does that mean, stacks? Explain that. That's kind of a technical. You said there was
rooftop stack. Stack from where the emissions would be blowing out of the facility for their processes.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
and the
NRC approved of this? They, like, ignored it all and didn't regulate it?
Their predecessor. Yeah. And see, that's what's really striking here, that the Atomic Energy Commission, you know, you had the owner, okay, the founder of NUMEC, went in. He was an entrepreneur, scientist, still alive, by the way. And came into the town and basically through a business venture, literally got that abandoned steel mill that had dirt floors in it for free. Now, who isn't going to jump at that? But here's the thing. The last line of approval was held by the Atomic Energy Commission. And they had to come out there. They had to assess the area. They had to see the close proximity to everything. So what were they thinking? What was in their minds when they approved this?
That was 1957, the same.
To me, 1957, to me, it likens to, on a milder scale, it likens to a complete drunk going in to the Department of Motor Vehicles, throwing up an empty bottle of Jack Daniels, falling down, asking for a driver's license, and getting it.
Wow. Okay, so now your dad asked you to investigate. Now, why did he ask you to investigate that place? I mean, what was the purpose for him?
My dad?
Yeah. Was he working there at the time or
no,
what?
No. We had a deli that was attached to our house, and my dad had retired from the steel mills. And in their twilight years, you know, everybody has to have a sense of productivity. And they had this deli. And it was going through a decommissioning, the paper aspect of it. Work really hadn't started on the outside. And there were questions. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was there. And my dad had told me, he said, "Patty, I want you to look into this. You're a trained investigator. Please look into this for us." I said, "What is it?" And he says, "Well, that's a nuclear plant over there." And that was the first time I ever heard the word nuclear associated with that plant, because I didn't know.
When did your dad know it was a nuclear plant?
Well, when I came back, there had been discussions, there had been meetings. The NRC was already there having exit meetings, what they called exit meetings, in the town. And some of the people would go. And, of course, you know, word gets around quick in small towns. And so when he had asked me to look into it, he was saying that the company wasn't saying anything. And I told him, a company's not going to say anything that can be detrimental to them. They're going to protect their liabilities. And then he told me the Nuclear Regulatory Commission wasn't saying anything either. And I thought this odd because, you know, I was really naive about our government. I associated our government with our country. What became very apparent to me is the total separation between our country and our government. The government is pure politics.
Huh. Wow. So the government knew that this was a nuclear facility since 1957. When did you start investigating it?
December of 1988.
So from 57 to 88, our government knew that this was not only a plutonium facility where they made plutonium, but they also knew that there was houses and people and that it had in fact, when you say it had a loss of material, that means that people were being poisoned with exposure to plutonium. Our government knew that.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. And again, the Parks Township facility was the plutonium facility. Apollo was a uranium hexafluoride facility and also a beryllium vendor. So there was all kinds of stuff going up the stacks, the 124 stacks in Apollo. And, we were getting dosed quite a bit. And, you know, even to present day, I often think, geez, why did they situate that here in the corporate confines of a town? In stone throws distance away from people's homes, where people travel, where people walk. And even the Silkwood plant was out in the boondocks. And sometimes I have to think that there's two methodologies that the government uses for studies. And one is by design, and one is by opportunity.
Ah, that's a very good statement. That's mm-hmm. That's actually true. So there was an opportunity to fill up an abandoned steel plant with this plutonium. 57 is an interesting year because 1957 is the very year that the Atomic Energy Agency and the World Health Organization signed a contract to allow the Atomic Energy Agency to have censorship authority over the World Health Organization. It was also the same year that the stuff in St. Louis began to happen, like the cover up of what happened in St. Louis began. So that I wonder who was running. I'm going to do some research. I'm going to make a note to myself because I wonder who ran the Atomic Energy Agency in 57, because whoever it was had no regard for human life, and they still don't. But so let's continue with this story because this is so fascinating. So you got
Well,
involved investigating.
there was one other facility that started up in 57 as well. And that is the mirrored sister facility to NUMEC Apollo, and that is Nuclear Fuel Services in Erwin, Tennessee, which is still running and which the current owners are one of my favorite companies. And I'm saying that in a very tongue-in-cheek manner. And that would be Babcock and Wilcox.
Wow.
Yes, same company that was up here.
Wow. And that's what town is that in?
Erwin, Tennessee.
So we can almost
I'd like to
guarantee.
give a shout out, if I could, to the activists down there, Linda Modica, and Barb O'Neill, and Trudy Payne Wallach, and the rest of the ladies down there. They've been absolutely fabulous.
Wow. Well, so let's get back. So your dad asked you to investigate. What did you find? What happened after that?
Well, it's a collection of documents that was going up to the library in Apollo, where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission put microfiche in a microfiche viewer, and where you could look over the documents that they had there. And I could tell immediately that there were certain microfiche that weren't there because of the sequential numbers having gaps. And but one of the things that I had noticed right away was a lot of the documents, internal documents, with respect to the workers, they were not redacted. I mean, they had their names, their social security numbers, everything on them.
Wow.
Yeah. And I started this microfiche viewer had a printer on it too, so I started printing a lot of these up. But the first document I ever read was a 1957 pre-startup document by a Pittsburgh engineering firm. And what that firm did was to come out and they did testing in the unrestricted areas of the town of Apollo. Now, that was good because it actually showed a baseline of the levels of radiation or radionuclides within the soil. And I believe it was between 2 and 4 picocuries per gram in the soil. And on page 4 of this report that they did, the second paragraph in there was real simple. They recommended continued testing and monitoring in the unrestricted areas of the town for the potential of changes, future changes in state and federal laws and regulations, and for the potential of future litigation, that those values would be enormously of value. Now, in 1957, they're in a pre-startup, right before they're getting ready to start up, and they're already worried about litigation.
Yeah, well, they obviously didn't know that in 1957 the Price-Anderson Act started up. So that's another one that happened in 56. 57 was a big year for nuclear, obviously. Obviously, they tidied up a lot of details. So they started looking, and then what did you find, and where did your journey take you? Why did it take 27 years? What happened?
Well, the plants were still working. And so when I started finally asking questions after I saw how the NRC was running the show, giving, just a bunch of jambalaya mixing up the formulas, the testing. They would mix Beckwills with, you know, Milrems and et cetera. And they did this with purpose to confuse and intimidate the people because they knew the demographics here.
Mm-hmm.
They knew. I mean, this our area is the salt of the earth, working class people. They come from steel mills, foundries, and mines.
Right.
And, you know, so there was one meeting where an NRC official told this one woman who asked about off-site testing and did they find any contamination. And this manager of the NRC, project manager, told her, you know, the response in all these formulas. And I watched her just wilt down. And she stood back up again and asked the question, could you just give me a yes or no? I didn't understand what you said. And he told her to sit down and shut up.
Wow.
That she had her question. And I went off at that point.
Good for you.
And
it
told me a lot. There was a realization of what was going on that was, I mean, it really took the innocence and the possibility, or the probability of a simple answer to all this, or a simple remedy. It took it right out. It took it right away, right out of the equation. And I knew that this was going to be a hell of a fight.
That was your come to Jesus moment, you know.
Yeah, that was my hit on the head. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Or a Scooby-Doo moment, as I call it, where you're going like, arr? Like what? Say what? Like, I can't, you know, we're shocked. I agree with you. I know exactly what you mean. When we look at these elected officials, they're not even elected. These are appointed officials in the, you know, nuclear regulatory. The Atomic Energy Agency Commission is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's their new, I mean, they renamed themselves because they were so bad they had to come up with a new name.
Well, the AEC was abolished.
Right.
And so was the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. One really has to ask why.
Right.
They said because. Why? You cannot be a regulator and promote the industry as well. There's a conflict of interest. But I am quite sure there's a whole heck of a lot more to it. You know,
It's protecting the accountability. So what happened after you found out? Like, then what happened? Like, what was your end desire? What was your end goal? And what transpired in between that meeting and the net result of you winning in court? What happened there?
Well, I had to raise the level of awareness to the people because I already knew that they had threatened these workers. And I knew this because my brother-in-law worked there, because I tried to ask him some questions. And he told me point blank that he couldn't talk about it. He would go to jail.
Wow.
And so when I kept asking him, I said, look, we're family here. He was very nervous, and he was scared. A lot of the workers were. And so I knew that they were going out. They were due. Their lifespan was up. The gig was up here. And they were trying to go quietly into the night with no one being the wiser. And that term is actually in some of the company confidential documents.
No one being the wiser?
No one being the wiser.
Wow. So that implies intentional deception. They knew what they were covering up. They knew
oh,
the
yeah.
harm.
And one such document that actually uses that was their insurance carrier. And this was after a loss of an enormous amount of material that went up the stacks, down the river, and we're talking, I think, at least 36 kgs of material.
Oh, my God. And plutonium has a half-life of several hundred thousand years. I think
plutonium-239, for example, has a half-life of approximately 27,000 years in that ballpark. Uranium-235 has a half-life of approximately 704 million years.
Oh, my God. And all of that stuff is still in our environment. That's the downside. It's all still in our... Now, what's the cancer clusters like around there?
The cancer clusters are... I mean, it's never-ending.
And autism rates and diabetes and schizophrenia, all the things that we know is caused by nuclear pollution.
Well, no, and documented are two different things. Because, I mean, they are trying to continuously refute causation to cancers with respect to exposures. And I don't know where they're drawing this from, especially when the United States government established the Energy Employees Occupational Insurance Compensation Program Act, the EEOICPA, for the workers. And they're showing 22 cancers as direct causation. Now, I was told by a senior staffer down in Washington, D.C., that the reason why it was limited to 22 was purely budgetary.
Wow.
Because in comparison and contrast, when you look at the Veterans Administration to the cancers they were covering for the atomic veterans that went through the dust clouds, et cetera, they covered every cancer under the sun.
Wow.
Now, why is there such a difference between federal standards?
Because, you know, this is the crime against humanity. You know, Dr. Alvin Weinberg gave a speech in 1972. He was a very strong pro-nuclear proponent who said the chance of a nuclear meltdown was so infinitesimal we didn't have to worry about it. In his speech that he gave in 1972, he literally said this about plutonium-239 is lethal to man in about 1/16,000th of a gram if ingested in the lungs. 1/16,000th of a gram if ingested in the lungs is lethal to man. He said that in a speech in 1972. And all the while, here you were in 1972, just, you know, you picked this mantle up in 1988, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, so they knew for at least a super long time that they were poisoning the people in your area. So, okay, so you investigate this, and then what happened? Where did you this story?
I was going out to raising awareness. And, of course, the people in the community, because their husbands and family members worked at NUMEC, they weren't having any part to it. I mean, really, when you stand back and you look at it, who the hell was Patty Amino when the government was here reassuring everybody? And even though they might have had some questions, they went with believing and trusting in our government.
Can we say Fukushima? Hello, can we say Fukushima? The president gets in front of a microphone and says, don't worry, everything's fine. So then what happened?
I heard so much of this at these meetings where not only the companies, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would come out and say that everything was perfectly safe and nothing went over the fence. And I remember one day I was standing out in front of my mom and dad's house and I was looking at that plant. And then I started looking all around the mountains that was behind it across the river, which was only 200 feet across the river. And all the way around, how it just sat in the valley. And I started thinking, wait a minute. They're saying, and they want us to believe, that absolutely nothing went over that fence. The only way that that could happen is if those radionuclides had a level of intelligence and that when they came to that fence line, they just put on the brakes and said, hold it, fellas, we can't go anymore. That is irrational logic.
Right.
And, you know, it's, what do you do at that point?
So what did you do? Did you litigate against the NRC? Or
I did, but it wasn't until I was outside picketing in front of the plant with sandwich board signs on my body and one in each hand and raising the specter of awareness and getting people interested in asking questions at this meeting. But I was still out there by myself. And trust me here, these people were starting to have their hands full because people were getting sick.
Right.
There were parents here burying their kids.
Right.
And And trust me, it was not through God's design.
No.
After all four of my brake lines being cut in June, July of 1993, and then on September 15th, 1993, being arrested at a public meeting that I had coordinated with the late U.S. Congressman Jack Murtha to have representatives from all the agencies there. I was arrested for asking too many questions.
Wow.
After that was in September. In November, I got attorneys in. And the attorneys I got in, that was the powerhouse.
And who was this attorneys that you got? What's their...
Well, I had called Bill Silkwood, the father of the late Karen Silkwood at the time. Bill's now gone as well. And I had told him about my plight because, I was being harassed. I was getting stopped. They wanted to see my driver's license was okay, my insurance, my registration, all this. I knew, because I was considered an obstructionist, a radical, somebody out to do harm. And they had the community pretty well convinced of that.
Wow.
When I spoke to Bill Silkwood, I asked him if he knew about NUMIC, and he says, oh, yeah. I said, you do? He says, yeah. I said, I need to get somebody here. I told him what happened to my brake lines. I told him what happened at the meeting, getting arrested. He said, yes, you need an attorney. He said, you need to talk to Steve Walker. I said, who is that? He says, well, he was the subject of one of the characters in the movie Silkwood, but he wanted his name changed because he didn't want that notoriety. And he gave me Steve's phone number. And he told me, tell him I said hello. So I called up Steve Walker right away and spoke to him and told him about it. He knew about NUMIC. And he asked me if I had any documents, and I said, yes. He said, can you send me some? I said, how many do you want? He said, how many do you have? I said, I have tens of thousands right now. And he said, well, just the most demonstrative ones that you think. I said, and I had asked him, do you want any videotape? He laughed. He said, you have videotape, too. I said, oh, yeah. He said, send it on. I mailed it as soon as I got off the phone. I packaged this stuff up, and I sent it overnight express. Steve was in my living room 3 days later.
Wow. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Now, that was in, October, November. And then Steve went and got, he knew this was going to be a huge, huge case. And so he got Fred Barron, and I met with Fred. And I said, yeah, I like him much. This is a go. And Fred was the trailblazer on asbestos litigation in this country.
Okay. How long were you guys in court? I mean, what was the net result of your fighting and really being diligent? What ended up happening? What was your case about, and what was the net result of your case?
Well, when the case was filed, it was filed on June the 6th, 1994.
Okay.
In federal court in Pittsburgh. Then people started waking up. And believe me, it wasn't just about money. It was about, wow, what that did, what Steve Walker and Fred Barron did, was validate that there was a serious problem there. And they also validated everything that I had been saying. And that case, again, was filed on June the 6th, 1994. We marched up the federal courthouse stairs on August the 10th, 1998, and it was a seven-week-long trial. And Fred did not do class action. He did mass action, and because each case was different, and it was on its own merits. And he took 8 of the 200 plaintiffs at that particular time, is what was there, and he promised to march each group case after case after case. And after 7 weeks, the jury came back unanimous Because in the federal civil action, you don't need all 12. You only need 9 out of the 12. But we had a unanimous jury that not only was Atlantic Richfield Corporation and Babcock and Wilcox negligent, they wrote on that charge paper for their verdict that they were outrageous and grossly negligent in the conduct of their company. Wow. And they awarded the first 8 test plaintiffs approximately $38.6 million for the first 8. Wow. But that was appealed. And that case ended in 2009. Yes, it was protracted out for a 14-year-long case. And here's why. Here's why. Because these corporations have their contract attorneys or their insurance attorneys. And this is Sugar Hill for them. It's a thing called billable hours.
Right.
They had attorneys, actually, the last several years of the case, billing $1,000 an hour.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And the companies would gladly pay this out rather than give a cent to these people that they had poisoned.
And how many of the people that they sued had died in the interim?
Oh, my God. Well, this is the reason why the case, the number of plaintiffs went from 200 up well up over 600 because the majority of them started dying. And so the reason why the greater number was because of children and their heirs.
Wow.
That were left to carry that case on. And it's sad.
Wow, and I wonder how many of their children. This is the thing about nuclear pollution and about plutonium. I mean, it doesn't just affect you. This is where it's, you know, slightly different than, say, the lead poisoning in Flint. While it's catastrophic in Flint, nuclear pollution affects your children. It affects your DNA, and it's a hidden seed that we can't see for a very long time.
Exactly. You know, molecular biologists have long suspected, and you know, it's definite now that you know, exposure to ionizing radiation not only mutates the cells, but goes straight to the heart of the DNA and alters that. And so what we're going to be seeing, in effect, is a birth, artificially induced birth defects at the hands of the nuclear industry.
Yes, and we have seen that. And actually, in the book that I read, I've read two books on my YouTube channel by Dr. John Goffman. And in both books, he discusses the fact that it's not just cancer, it is diabetes. It is schizophrenia, it's birth defects, it is autism. All these things are all strong contaminants from the nuclear pollution. And so, you know, they've known since the late 60s how. Now, let me ask you this, Patty. This gets kind of to the root of why I really enjoy talking with you, because you've had the experience, you had the tenacity to stick with it and not give up with these people. Because most people, they expect us to just give up. It's an exhausting trip to do this, and it takes a lot of personal integrity and energy to do it. But honestly, In your mind, you've dealt with the NRC and the government agencies for a long time. Why is our government so completely committed to the 90% rule, as John Goffman outlined it? Like, they deny radiation causes harm. They underreport the negative effects of radiation by 90%. Why do they refuse to just be honest brokers and say, you know what, this stuff is just too toxic, and follow the advice of the original scientists who said nuclear is exciting, but we need to study it before we put it into the general public? Have you gotten a sense of why they've done this?
Look, the government, our government, has never once admitted on any level for anything that they did something wrong. Never. And they never will. They'll never admit that they lied. they'll never admit that they misrepresent the truth or deceive the people or that they brought harm. No, they're not going to do that. And the reason for this coziness for all these years is just that. It's the industrial-military complex. And that is exactly what President Dwight David Eisenhower warned the public about upon his exiting office. And the people kind of went on deaf ears. They didn't have that grasp of what was going on. Whew.
Well,
you know, I do now. Like, I remember that on television, seeing that actually. And I was born in 51. And so when you look at this, we have to have weapons. This is an excuse to have more weapons for the military, for the defense. Okay?
We have plenty of nuclear
weapons. Production going, and that increases their budgets. It's all about money.
Right.
It's all about money.
Right. Peace is bad for the profit line. That's kind of the bottom line.
Well, peace is bad for the budget for the Defense Department. If we have peace, if we don't have an enemy, are you kidding me?
Well, let's be clear. We do have an enemy. It's called nuclear pollution. It's everywhere. And frankly, this is what I don't get. They could shift their focus. The same people pushing nuclear on us could actually make boatloads of money in the scientific community searching for solutions instead of just there's no budget for finding solutions. All they do is want to create more pollution. They totally deny any harm by radiation, and it's really like suicide. It's just unconscionable what they're doing to mass of our population. John Goffman's title of his book, Nuclear Population Control Through Nuclear Pollution.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing right there, the pollution. But the one thing that has never, ever, ever been addressed, not by the nuclear industry and not by the regulators, the AEC, the NRC, the state, environmental, none of them, not being addressed in a proper way, and that is the waste.
All right.
There hasn't been one cent, not one cent, that has gone into research specifically for any types of developments in the neutralization of the hazards of the radioactive waste. Not one speck of research, not one cent has gone into it. Now, one would think that this would be done because, you know, think
that's
about
the elephant
environment.
In the room. Yeah.
But on the other side of it, the companies really don't care about it because that means they would have to probably pony up some money, and they're not going to want to do that. And the other reason why they feel safe in not going forward with something like this is because they have the protection of the United States government.
Right. Well, they have the Price-Anderson Act. No, it's a complete indemnification. I mean, honestly...
Yeah.
It shocked me, you know, the people of St. Louis, bless their hearts, they have pushed through some legislation, but in number two article, when I read both those pieces of legislation in the House and in the Congress, listed, number two article, listed as a cost-saving measure. This is what shocked me. It's listed as a cost-saving measure, was complete indemnification for past, present, or future harm caused to anybody by the nuclear pollution there.
I don't know how they can do that. I don't know how they can do that. I don't know how they can speak for given the nature of the element that you're dealing with. I don't know how they can speak for the people that are currently here, the people that are past, and the people that have yet to come. I don't know how they can speak to that. And if people really focus in, and if the government really focused in on what the overall cost has been, the burden to the taxpayers' dollars and this country, on the overall scope of things with respect to all things nuclear, you think of all the contracts. Here's a tidbit. Okay, when the government gave these contracts out to these fabricating facilities like NUMEC and Babcock and Wilcox, like Mellenkraut, okay, they not only paid them for the goods that they wanted, but they also gave them additional monies for housekeeping. But the companies pocketed the money And they kind of had a industry type cartel, as a matter of speaking, that one would do the other a favor. Some of them would bury waste for the other ones. They would pay them a small fee, and they'd both be up ahead monetarily without having to pay the enormous fees in sending it to a place like Barnwell or out there in Utah. And it's crazy.
Well, it is
crazy. Rocky Flats had a muff, a material unaccounted for, a plutonium that was so huge, it was classified for 35 years.
Wow.
35 years. It was so huge. Now, diversion of the material never came on the radar. Theft of the material never came on the radar. The only consideration for that classification of that material being classified for all those years was the implications to the environment. Now, what has history told us about that when that cat came out of the bag? They were sued. And by 6,000 plaintiffs on property alone. And I don't know what the status of that case is. I know it was ongoing and it's been in appeals. But I think the initial jury awarded them something like $532 million.
Wow.
You know, and it went into appeals. And it's always an uphill battle. It's
wow.
always an uphill battle. The people of this country, we do not have an equal access to justice with respect to this. And that's exactly what we need. And on a state level, people need to start working because these acts are criminal. And I've been working on this for several months, over a year actually, with a state representative here in my area. And he happens to now be on a chairman, Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. There's absolutely no statute of limitations on homicide.
Wow. And you're telling me your congressperson is willing to get engaged in that fight?
He's my state representative. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Because they actually were raised initially, his family, right beside the plutonium facility. And his dad was a former state rep as well. And he always backed me up,
wow.
too.
We have just about 10 minutes left, so I want to kind of go over that. You know, this is one of the reasons that I'm really excited to have met you, is that you actually have taken action, you've been diligent. So what could you suggest to activists that are out there that are engaging in issues in their area, and they go against, you know, they contact their elected officials or state officials, and their officials just don't seem to be warmed up to this idea. How long did it take you to get your own representative to be open? I mean, what actions did you take that allowed that person to go, wow, maybe this is an issue? What's the process with that?
You have to marshal in some attorneys. That is the length and breadth of it. Because, let me tell you, the most important thing for me out of that federal civil action was a thing called discovery. It's a beautiful thing. That's when you get documents that have never seen the light of day before. And that story starts really falling into pieces. You start seeing these documents that were not in the public domain, such as, you know, there was so much material lost. Thank goodness. One can't help wonder where the media was on this. Thank goodness that no one will be the wiser.
Wow.
You know, another one. Plutonium is all over the place. We are subject to lose our license. Dilution is no longer the solution.
Huh.
That was from the health physicist, Dr. Roger Caldwell.
Well, they're still training people on that. You know, I mean, every dentist that x-rays your mouth will tell you that. Don't worry. It's just not enough, you know. So, look, in terms of contacting attorneys, I'm going to jump in here. The attorneys that are helping the USS Reagan, and those are the men that I know. I've made contact with them. I'm in contact with Charles Bonner of Bonner and Bonner Attorneys at Law out in California. They're representing the USS Reagan. We're attempting to figure out when they can come on my show and update us on this. He has given me, he has a.
So is Paul Gardner. He's representing too.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to give out that number because people can take action. You can contact the, bonnerlaw.com, and people can actually send them a contact. You can find them on the internet. People, I mean, honestly, we really do need to start litigation and figure out how, and I love your idea that maybe we need to go after them for murder because it is murder what they're doing.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt. And there's your center point, your nucleus start point would be with the former workers.
Right.
That's your center point. Because they're going to get into causation on anything outside of the work environment.
Wow.
And here's something else with respect to legal, the legalities and attorneys. I would strongly recommend an entity called Public Justice.
Okay.
There are affiliations of law firms that are plaintiffs' attorneys. You never, 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 ever, never want to get a law firm that has represented corporations as well as plaintiffs for different things. Never.
That's called
Strictly,
publicjustice.net.
I believe it's publicjustice.org.
Okay. PC. Now there's a Center for Public Justice.org, or there is, it says publicjustice.net.
Well, try both.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of the deal. It's kind of like through throwing spaghetti on the wall. We have to keep going. And this is the issue here. The majority of the population has not even engaged on this topic. And they really are very afraid because, like you and like me, we are now being deemed like radicals and extremists. I mean, even my own children have said to me, "Mom, you're pretty extreme about this." I'm like, "Hell yeah, I'm extreme. It's killing everybody." What do you guys were just laying down and like for most of my life, 57 years of my life, I thought the government was protecting us. And then I'm realizing, oh my God, no, they're actually using us like lab rats.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of such, you will find that in the majority of cases, NIH, the National Institute of Health, has been at these sites very quietly, and specifically where there's been rare cancers that's come up. We've had several appendiceal cancers here. We've had several men with breast cancer. The only known causation to that is radiation exposure.
Wow.
But the industry, and specifically the regulatory agency said, well, it possibly came from the fallout, from the weapons testing. We were supposed to ignore the fact that we had not one, but two nuclear fuel processing facilities within a 3 air mile radius of each other.
That is so unconscionable that anybody could actually work for that engine industry and spew those words out. Like, it's unconscionable. It's
Yeah.
unconscionable.
You said it right. You were dead on. This is coming from governmental government regulators, but you said working for the industry, and that's exactly what they do. Look, even the IAEA has in their charter that they are to promote the nuclear industry.
That's right. That's a
How can you promote it and regulate it? You cannot. That's the very reason why the Atomic Energy Commission was abolished. At
right.
least on the surface, as we know.
The
I think it was far
AEC.
greater. I think it was far greater because the AEC was uncaring about what was going on with the waste. And at a higher level in our government, the highest level of investigative agencies, they put the FBI in charge of investigating this alleged diversion here to give it some to validate it, and here the FBI was chasing their tail unknowingly until, and that was from the mid-60s until
Wow.
the 70s when it pivoted from a diversion material to obstruction of justice. That's when they called in the former members of the Atomic or the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. You're talking about elected officials and generals.
Well, look,
and AEC officials.
You know, Barbara Boxer, who is leaving her post this year, she's actually at the NRC hearings last year regarding San Onofre, has requested documents that the NRC to this day is refusing to give her. Now,
yeah.
That to me, that tells me they are completely a rogue agency that is completely unaccountable even to Congress. They're refusing to give Congress documents they have requested.
Look, I got Senator Bob Casey to do an to call for an investigation, which we got, on what happened with the cleanup of our SLDA initially that caused it to come to a full stop in September of 2011. Now, understand that Babcock & Wilcox and Atlantic Richfield Corporation had a characterization report that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission signed off on and told the Army Corps of Engineers that this was the holy grail of what was buried there. And also understand that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was kicked between the legs by Congressman Jack Murtha when he legislated that site, a license, active license site, right out of the house of the NRC. That hadn't been done before.
Wow.
And
it's never been done. Wow.
So they had a bitter taste in their mouth about all this. And, you know, I think it's rational to assume that they were upset about it. And so when...
You know, that's the shocking thing. You'd think that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who really says their charter is to protect public health, would be grateful that citizens are actively engaging and letting them know about situations that are knowingly causing harm to people.
That mission is five-pronged. Two of the prongs is protect the health and safety of the people in the public, and the second one is to protect the environment out of the five. And they have failed. They have failed miserably. They haven't even tried to protect the health and safety of the people. They have been fueled and geared and driven by the industry in and of itself.
It is really, look, we have a minute and a half left of the show, Patty. Is there a website or is there any place where you would suggest that people go to start taking action, or is there anything you'd like to tell
us? Well, first of all, the first mode of action is to educate yourself. And there are so many people that are out here that have been of service to people like myself, activists. I'm like a grunt in the trenches up front. And, you know, you have Bob Alvarez, my goodness, you have Dr. Marvin Reznikoff, you have Dr. Arjun Markiajani, who has a wonderful website. That's www.ieer.org. That stands for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Arjun, by the way, was one of our experts in the first federal civil action. I actually spearheaded a second one that was filed in January of 2010.
That's
and
awesome.
As long as I have a breath in my body and the availability of plaintiff's attorneys, I'm going to keep on having these things filed.
Well, thank you,
Patty.
Look, we have about 15 seconds. I want to thank you for being on our show. I hope you can come back. I encourage all of my listeners, put your courage feet on, take some action, do it afraid, educate yourself. It is up to us to balance this situation out and get some justice for the people of our planet. Put your courage feet on. Thanks, Patty, for joining us. I really
You're
appreciate
welcome,
it.
And I would tell the people to stand up, speak up, and act up.
Stand up, speak up, and act up. Great advice. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lauren.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.